And, you know, another big consideration that comes up when you're looking at whether something is or isn't real property for 1031 exchanges is what is the unit of property that you're looking at? It's one thing if you've got, you know, land and a building, you kind of know what it is. But what if you have, you know, in oil and gas, I can think of a lot of complicated assets that are, you know, attached to land, like a, maybe a saltwater disposal well or a big refinery. You may have, you know, components of that that are removable, easily interchangeable. Are you looking at the entire unit of property to determine whether it is or is not real property in its entirety? Or are you looking at the subcomponents of it? I think the REIT regs address this to some degree. Steve, do you think that the 1031 regs might, you know, look to what is the unit of property at issue?
Yeah, it's almost like it's almost like these our 1031 regulations would have to get into
how granular do you get?
That's right. Because certainly those determinations, those would be important determinations in determining whether you have real property and whether you have a good like-kind exchange. And as you said, the 856 regs again have a nice, you know, a nice model to follow if we go in that direction.
Right. Okay, so we'll jump ahead to oil and gas, and Robert's going to kick us off there.
So in keeping with the theme that real property is intended to still be defined broadly, most oil and gas interests will qualify, you know, working interest, royalties, overriding royalties, net profits interest. A few things that don't qualify, such as production payments, which are expected to have a life of shorter duration than the life of the reserves, and those are treated as loans. So those would not qualify as part of a like-kind exchange. A few key issues that come up a lot in my practice, I know Todd's as well, are issues surrounding, you know, sell versus lease aspects, transactions, tax partnerships, and recapture. So talking about sell versus lease, oftentimes when a seller of a working interest finds a buyer, the buyer may be only willing to pay for a certain level of net revenue interest. So as a means of capturing any excess NRI, the seller will often carve off a royalty and sell the remainder of the working interest. If that is kind of contemporaneous with the transaction, then it converts what would otherwise be a sell transaction into a lease. And because a lease transaction is not a seller exchange, you've now taken what would otherwise be a transaction that's eligible for a 1031 exchange and convert it into a transaction that's not eligible. This determination is made on a lease-by-lease basis, so it's not like it taints the entire transaction that you're working on, but instead is analyzed lease-by-lease. So if you retain a royalty on one lease but not on another, you can still do a 1031 for part of the transaction. Just the lease where you retain the royalty will not be eligible for 1031 treatment. There's a couple of ways to solve this, and I want to get kind of Steve's view as well. You know, oftentimes people will, well in advance of a transaction, carve off a royalty, or maybe they have a practice of doing this every time they acquire working interest, kind of evaluate whether there's going to be an excess NRI and carve it off ahead of time, whether that's you know, contemporaneous with an acquisition, knowing that they're going to sell it down the road, or if it's a bit later, kind of varies. You know, I think there's obviously risk anytime you're doing that. You know, you want to have a business purpose for this. And the closer in time you get to a sell, you know, when you carve it off, probably the more riskier the transaction. I don't know, Steve, if you have any kind of views on those types of arrangements.
Yes, I mean, certainly selling it to a related party raises the risk that it's just a sham and you're just doing it to, you know, get rid of the entire interest rather than just the working interest and retaining the royalty interest. So certainly unrelated parties better than related parties, but there's I don't think there's anything per se wrong with transferring it to a related party as long as it's a transaction that would be respected. And you know, perhaps if it's in the a consolidated group situation, that may, you know, the various members may be considered divisions rather than separate taxpayers, so that may be a problem. But yeah, I mean, I don't think anything per se wrong with that as long as you cover all the bases like you mentioned.
Yeah. I think you generally want to have a strong business purpose for that carve out. And you wouldn't want to do it on the eve of closing and have no apparent reason for what you did other than so you could have a good 1031 exchange rather than a leasing transaction. It might look kind of bad. I mean, when our clients do this, I think the most common is folks who carve off the royalties, the excess overriding royalty above whatever NRI they expect to sell upon an eventual exit. They carve that off programmatically. So every time they acquire a new package of leases, you know, it's just in their system to carve off that ORI, you know, either at the end of the month or every quarter, something like that, and convey it to a separate but related entity. You got to be careful that you're conveying it to, you know, a separate regarded taxpayer, not to a disregarded entity in your chain.